Hi, I'm Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight we have with us Dr. David Kaiser, and we're going to talk about his new book, How the Hippies Save Physics. And if you haven't put your hands on this book and you're interested in the science of consciousness and what's been going on with Elizabeth Rauscher and Fred Alan Wolf and David Bohm and many, many others over the years, you need to get this book. So how are you, Dr. Kaiser?
I'm great, Eva. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's my pleasure, and I appreciate your taking the time to do so. So before we get started, please tell us a little bit about you, how you came to do what you do at MIT. I understand that's where you work now. And
sure.
How you got started in an interest in consciousness.
Sure. Well, I'm a professor at MIT. I teach both in the physics department, and I also teach the history of science in the program in science, technology, and society. And before that, I was studying at Harvard, and I was studying both theoretical physics and the history of science. And so I've been a kind of physics junkie for a long time, since I was a kid, and I would read all the popular science books I could get my hands on, even in junior high and high school. And then when I got to college, I jumped right into a physics major and never looked back. And so I've been really fascinated by quantum theory, for a long time. And when I was wearing my historian's cap, I got really interested in the question of who within physics has asked questions about the kind of foundations of quantum theory, not just the equations and not just the experiments. Those are all really important. But there's also, especially with quantum theory and to some degree with relativity and other aspects of modern physics, there are these really deep, puzzling philosophical nuggets as well that go well beyond the equations themselves. And those are the kinds of things that fascinated me to read about even before I was learning the equations and then all through college and graduate school and doing my PhDs and all that. And so I was curious about how the activity of thinking hard about things like Schrödinger's cat or wave-particle duality or all these sort of rich but somewhat counterintuitive notions of quantum theory, who's cared about that over time? How do those questions rise to the forefront or sometimes get pushed very much to the margins? And so that was the kind of set of questions I had in mind when I started working on the book.
So just from the very first question I want to ask you, because it seems to be an important question across the board, when you talk about consciousness, what is your definition of that thing? What are you asking?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's to say, I mean, I guess I, what I would come up with on my own would be something like a state of maybe self-awareness or something like that. Although I have to say, for when working on the book, what mattered most to me was not my own definition of consciousness, which is not well articulated, as you can tell, but rather what did that question or that set of ideas mean to a bunch of other people. So I was tracing through, who thought that was a burning question. What ideas do they bring to the fore when trying to grapple with it, and how they communicate their ideas, who else was listening, who else was ignoring it. So it was less a question for me personally, what did I think consciousness was, and quite frankly, I don't have a great, detailed answer, but rather to follow the other people around and say, who was getting excited about it? How were they pursuing their ideas and spreading their ideas around?
Okay, so let's start off, obviously, with the fundamental physics group. I know most of those people, and I've studied all their work, and they've been my heroes, basically, for a long time, and so are they for many of my listeners. But I had no idea that something called the Fundamental Physics Group existed and how the movement got started. So could you tell us what that is and who was involved in it and what they were doing, how they started out?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it was a real pleasure while working on the book to actually to learn more about the group and then the individuals and get to know some of them as well, even to this day. So it was a group that was a very informal discussion group that was founded in the spring of 1975, so going back a couple years. And they were founded actually by two people you know very well, Eva, Elizabeth Rauscher and George Weissman, who were both, at that time, they were both graduate students. They were both still pursuing their PhDs in theoretical physics at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory in California near San Francisco. And they were among those people who were deeply, deeply interested then as now in questions like physics and consciousness and the deep kind of wonder or the deep puzzles of modern physics and where they might lead. And they were coming up of age in the discipline. They were students at a time when those questions really were quite marginalized, really pretty extremely marginalized, in fact. So they were not being talked about in physics classes. They were not in the textbooks, not just consciousness itself, but even, one might have thought, more basic questions of interest to physicists, like what do the equations of quantum theory really imply about the nature of reality? What are these equations telling us? And that was the sort of question that had gotten each of them very excited when they were kids, and they were reading popular books when they were young. And went all through their training, they found that material just completely pushed aside and kind of ignored. And so both of them, as you know, are, what can I say, they're not content to let those things be pushed aside. These were their passions and their questions. And they were great organizers. So they organized this kind of informal weekly discussion group, and they gave themselves a very playful name, the one you mentioned, the Fundamental Physics Group. They spelled physics with an F just to show they were kind of being fun and not taking themselves too seriously. And they met every Friday afternoon around 4 o'clock for an informal discussion group. And it was open to anyone who cared to come. And at first it was just a small little group, maybe about 8 or 10 kind of core members. They met every week for nearly 4 years, through the mid to late 1970s. And sometimes their sessions would attract, you know, many dozens of people if they had a special outside speaker or the topic seemed especially juicy. And other weeks it would just be the sort of 8 or 10 or 12 of them just kind of having fun, but also trying to hash through or really kind of work through some of these really deep, puzzling questions about quantum theory and what it might imply. And so it started with people like Elizabeth and George, and then other members quickly joined them, like Nick Herbert and Jack Sarfati and Fred Allen Wolf, whom some listeners might, names they might know, Henry Stapp, who was a bit more senior than the rest. He was a staff scientist at the laboratory, and he would was a regular participant as well. Sometimes others would join them, like Jeffrey Chu, a very eminent particle physicist who was actually the advisor for some of those folks when they were students. Fridtjof Capra, who wrote the book The Tao of Physics, became a regular member, as did John Clauser, who's a renowned physicist today, who was conducting some of the world's very first laboratory tests of some of these very peculiar, very spooky quantum effects about quantum entanglement at a time when very few physicists cared. Many of them dismissed that as not real physics, and yet Clauser was very, very bravely and very doggedly doing these ingenious experiments, and one of the few groups he could even find to pay any attention were the other members of this group. He became an early kind of charter member as well. So it had, you know, a number of people who were regulars and who were sort of glad to have discussion mates, because they all shared this deep, deep interest in modern physics and other directions it might lead them.
So how did you find out that this group even existed? Because I've been interviewing for 10 years, and I can't believe, I was shocked that it was out there, and I never knew. How did you find out?
You know, it was, I think, a good part serendipity. I mean, so going back to my own sort of course toward the book, I was fascinated, again, all through college and graduate school in quantum theory. I still am. I still teach it and love thinking about it to this day. And one of the many real nuggets that's really fun to think about, and it's bizarre, it's, at least it's counterintuitive, is known as Bell's theorem or quantum entanglement. And that was a topic that just grabbed me when I was, you know, first learning the equations of quantum theory as a physics student. In graduate school, one of the first experiments I had to do in a laboratory course was actually reproducing in a very simplified form, a kind of benchtop student-friendly form, that very pioneering experiment that John Clauser had done back in the 70s, that was the first test of entanglement. And so I was just sort of captivated by that topic. Meanwhile, as a high school kid, before I'd even gotten to the real classes, I'd been reading popular books like The Tao of Physics, the one that Fritjof Capra wrote. I was reading it much after its initial heyday, but it was still in print. It's still in print today. It's a blockbuster, successful book. And basically, I figured there must have been something of interest going on, sort of bubbling up, percolating up in the 70s. We had John Clauser chasing Bell's theorem in the laboratory. We had people like Fritjof Capra writing very interesting and very sort of engaging popular books about the mysteries of modern physics or the sort of grandeur of thinking big thoughts. And basically, I was trying to sleuth out, you know, when I figured out they were both working in Berkeley for a while, did they know each other, and just kind of doing the detective work that historians often have to do, sort of piecing threads together. And then I found, you know, all these connections that the group had really forged at the time.
So I'm glad you brought up Bell's theorem, because that was one of my questions. I'm not a physicist and I'm not a scientist. I'm just an interviewer, you know, a journalist. I want to understand Bell's theorem and what that means to consciousness. Can you explain that better for us?
Well, I can try. I'm not sure I can explain what it means to consciousness, but I can at least try to explain what Bell's theorem means sort of in its own right, and we can take it from there. So it is one of these sort of, I think, just delightful aspects of quantum physics. It's another reminder of how just the laws of nature might not be what we grow up expecting from our everyday experience with things like, you know, baseballs or tennis rackets or driving on the highway. The physics that governs that doesn't always translate very well to the physics that can exist between atoms or parts of atoms. There can be new features that don't tend to show up, at least in common experience. And I think Bell's theorem or quantum entanglement, as it's often known, is a great example of that. So the basic idea is one can take a pair of quantum particles. They could be two electrons or two little bits of light, two photons, lots and lots of things. In fact, now people have done experiments with whole humongous fat globs of molecules that can be even huge collections of particles. But we have two of them, let's say a pair. And because of the way they are prepared, maybe they were spit out in a certain atomic reaction, or they could be part of a radioactive decay, actually fairly mundane ways to make these things in the laboratory these days. It's not a rare kind of event that these two particles can share very special properties, even as they move very far away from each other. So they can head off in opposite directions. And a physicist can be on one end of a laboratory room and decide to make a measurement of one of these pair of particles. She might measure any number of properties. It could be its spin, its sort of intrinsic angular momentum along a certain direction. It could be its position or momentum itself, for that matter. Any kind of mundane property, or almost any of these properties she might want to measure. She chooses to make a measurement on particle A, let's say. The very act of choosing to measure one particular property there is going to instantaneously affect what her partner finds on particle B, even if they are arbitrarily far away. And that's the part that starts to get kind of hairy, at least that raises the stakes, the intellectual stakes here. Because what people realized, especially members of this fundamental physics group, and began to push on this relentlessly with great fun, but also great skill and great discipline, they realized, is this aspect of quantum theory, this entanglement, is that on a collision course with Einstein's relativity? You'll recall relativity stipulates that nothing should be able to travel faster than light, not a force, not an individual particle or signal. And yet here is this very elegant, elegant paper by the physicist John Bell, that now we know as Bell's theorem, that shows in beautiful and very actually elegant mathematics that if the equations of quantum theory are true, and these are equations, mind you, that had held up in every single test for decades by that point, when they're used to explain the behavior of atoms and molecules, they're just spot on. So there's good reason to have confidence in those equations. And John Bell said, or proved, that if those equations are right, then there seems to be an instantaneous connection, instant, not just really fast, like speed of light, but infinitely fast, some sort of connection between what happens, say, with particle A and what happens with particle B, even if particle B is, you know, a galaxy away. And that's the part that really sounds truly unexpected to a physicist, or I think to any person, that what I do here might have an instant effect arbitrarily far away. And that's the sort of thing that they just grabbed members of this fundamental physics group. They said, how could nature work that way? If it does work that way, what else might it imply? And so people like John Clauser devised really brilliant experiments to try to test that effect in the laboratory. He was skeptical. He was hoping he would find it disproven. He figured that would be even more shocking if quantum mechanics failed. Instead, he and his student at the time, Stuart Friedman, conducted this experiment and found the predictions of quantum theory and of Bell's theorem spot on. They found exactly this spooky action at a distance, as Einstein had termed it, was really showing up in their data. And other members of the fundamental physics group who were hearing about these results from John sort of in real time, people like Fred Allen Wolf and George Weissman and Elizabeth Rauscher and Jack Sarfati and the whole group. These are folks who had PhDs in physics, like Clauser, from some of the nation's top programs. They were exquisitely well-trained. They knew the equations of quantum theory very, very well. And they were attuned. They were open to these more philosophical or foundational questions as well. And so they learned about Bell's theorem on paper. They heard updates on the experiments from their discussion mates, John Clauser, and they set to work. And in fact, they dominated the topic at a time when most physicists didn't even look up from their notepads. This was not a topic that had made it onto most people's attention. And that this group, along with a small number of others, but at the time they were really ahead of their time, they thought this was just, you know, fascinating and worth, you know, their concerted thought.
So I know the answer to this question, but for my listeners, what did their peers think of them, and how well traveled was the road?
It's a great question. It's one that I learned a lot about while working on the book. The short answer is that most of their peers didn't think of them at all. So, I mean, they had almost fallen off the radar screen, not entirely. But this was not mainstream hallway discussions in most physics departments at the time. And so one of the things that really drew me to the group and really got me excited when I started learning more was their great skill and their discipline and their hard work and training, but also, quite frankly, their courage, their tenacity. This was not stuff that was going to make an easy road to a good, steady job, and in fact, it didn't for many of them. So a backdrop to the whole story, the way I start the book, is that these folks made one big mistake, which was not really of their own fault. Their big mistake was graduating with their PhDs in physics at one of the worst times, probably the worst time in the history of the physics job market, you know, for decades and decades. So the late 60s and into the early 70s, when most of these people were finishing up their formal training, was just a horrible, horrible time to become a young physicist if you wanted to make a career that had seemed typical until that time. So at the end of World War II and after Sputnik and during the kind of high Cold War period of the 1950s and 60s, there were jobs aplenty for physicists. And in fact, even as more and more young people were getting trained in physics and getting excited about the field, there were more jobs on offer than even young physicists to fill them. It was a student's market. And those fortunes reversed very, very abruptly, very dramatically, basically by the early 70s, just as the folks whom I wrote about were coming along. So that by 1971, there were more than 1,000 young PhD physicists applying for just 50 jobs in the field. And those weren't just university jobs. Those were jobs in industries, in government laboratories. Anyone posting a job saying, I want to hire a physicist, at least those who went through a sort of central job placement clearinghouse where the records are clear, the market had gone from having more jobs than students to being a complete crash, really a bubble that had burst. And that's just when these folks, most of them, were then coming up through the ranks. So they were already having a pretty hard time, to put it mildly, a very hard time, getting a kind of stable job in the field that they loved and that they'd worked very hard for and done PhDs in. Remember, these folks weren't dropouts. They did PhDs at great, great places and had done all the hard work along the way. And suddenly, the way to become a young physicist was no longer what had once seemed natural or inevitable. And so they were already on the margins. And then they found each other. They made their way to Berkeley. They kind of bumbled along to the San Francisco Bay Area, each with his own or her own story. I kind of chart that out in the book a bit. Through the kind of accidents of history, they found each other in Berkeley. They discovered this shared interest, a shared kind of passion in physics, but also in this kind of philosophical deep questioning about the implications of physics. And they founded this study group, this kind of informal brainstorming session. And then they decided to put their energy into topics that were not at all popular with most physicists at the time. These were seen as merely philosophy, and that was meant to be, you know, a deep insult. And they, you know, most of them did not have a kind of stable, professional platform from which to attack these questions. So some had kind of minimal day jobs, which they certainly hadn't needed a PhD. Some were, at least for a while, unemployed. It was really quite dire for many of them. This was serious times. And yet they would not be kind of, deterred from, you know, asking big, deep questions about nature. And I found that really just, it was a wonderful thing to be able to discover and to learn more about while digging into the book.
Now, most of these people, if not all of them, I mean, there were Nobel Prize winners in them, right? I mean, these aren't just your run-of-the-mill, bottom-of-the-class physicists, right?
Well, and no Nobel Prize winners yet, although there was a lot of, a flurry of attention just this past autumn, that many people were predicting that John Clauser would share the Nobel Prize this year. He didn't. The prize went for a totally different discovery. But he is certainly, Clauser especially has won sort of the runner-up to Nobel Prize type awards within the field. He's won something called the Wolf Prize, very, very prestigious prize, and other things. So certainly, the physics world has rediscovered John Clauser. He was not celebrated for most of his career, but I should say, yeah, I think quite appropriately now, many, many people realize just how important his work has been, and that of some others, with whom he was working. There were other Nobel laureates, even back in the day, who did discover this group and were very avid discussion mates, and the most important being Brian Josephson, who is to this day working in Cambridge, England, and he won the Nobel Prize. I think he was 33 years old when he received the prize. Tells you something about how his career started. He was just very quick out of the gate, and a brilliant physicist, and someone who also had kind of broken from the mainstream. That by the time he discovered members of this group, his interests had also wandered beyond the kind of straight and narrow part of physics. So he then, as now, has been very interested in things like parapsychology, or what's often called ESP. So Josephson, brilliant Nobel laureate, with, we'll just say, wider interest than most of his other Nobel laureate peers. And he indeed was very avidly in discussion then, and still is, as far as I know, with several members of the group. So you're right that there were, you know, very high caliber people with whom they were interacting. Another one, not quite as strong an interaction, but he does pop up a lot in the book, was Eugene Wigner, the great Nobel laureate, who was a master of quantum mechanics and one of the greats of the field, and he was in some limited, much more limited interaction than someone like Brian Josephson. But
our connection, Don. I don't know if you can hear me, but something's going on. Can you hear me? Okay, Dave.
I can hear you. Okay, Eva. Yeah.
Okay, because you're going in and out to me.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But now it seems to be better. I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
Okay, well, anyway, I think another physicist with whom the group interacted was indeed another Nobel laureate, Eugene Wigner. They also had, you know, very, very long-standing interactions, conversations, mostly through the mail, through correspondence, with John Wheeler, who was another truly illustrious physicist, a giant of the field. Richard Feynman held them a bit more at arm's length, but they were in touch at some point as well. So the group had kind of tethers to some of the leading physicists of the day, even though they were still kind of on the margins of the profession.
So what was one of the things that intrigued you the most that you learned while you were doing this? That I don't want to say shocked you the most, but
yeah. Well, I guess I'd say that, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. So one of the things that really did shock me the most, or certainly surprised me, was just how far outside the mainstream topics like Bell's theorem or quantum entanglement had been, and for how long they remained out of the mainstream. And that was shocking to me because of where I am today. I mean, these days that is an absolutely central topic in modern physics. All the latest textbooks in quantum mechanics have extensive coverage of it, often right in the beginning. There are whole new graduate programs springing up basically around the study of Bell's theorem, not just physics, but there's a new exciting frontier area called quantum information science that includes quantum computing and quantum encryption and really amazing cutting-edge stuff. And everyone wants to learn it, and all the students students want to get in on it. And that's, and again, I think that's sort of as it should be. It's fascinating material. And that same exact topic, right, was what was getting people shunned for bringing it up and thinking hard about it just 3 or 4 decades ago, not all that long ago. So when people like members of the fundamental physics group said Bell's theorem is really important, we should you know, really drill down and figure it out, they were ignored or sometimes worse. They couldn't get mainstream jobs. John Clauser never got a university job, even though now he's in the running for the Nobel Prize, because at the time, department heads would say he might be a good experimenter, but he's not doing real physics. Who cares about this strange philosophy stuff? And in the course of a single lifetime, to watch a topic move from real kind of insult to centrality, that was I did find that actually quite fascinating. And also to learn...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, and furthermore, to learn the kind of, I'd say, tenacity of these kind of very smart and playful and you know, kind of fun, curious characters whom I wound up being able to write about, to see that they were playing a real supporting role and kind of out of the limelight, that they were keeping interest in this topic alive when many, many physicists chose to, you know, not to pay much attention at all.
Well, I'll tell you what I've found through my radio shows, and I've done hundreds of them. It seems to me that it's the hottest topic on the face of the earth right now. You know, for people to learn that they can use mind to change their reality, to change their lives and to change their health. And it's these people that have proven that and supported it and brought it to the attention of the world. I mean, with this thing, we can change the world and have immediate peace if we did it the right way. Did you have any opinions on that when you were interviewing these people?
Well, you know, I didn't. I mean, so what fascinated me, as I say, was a topic that now we rightly consider, you know, central, teach all our students, make sure they learn it in college kind of thing, that is to say quantum entanglement. To see how the kind of, you know, kind of Cinderella story, kind of rags to riches story, that this is something that was really just sidelined in a very, very, you know, very strong kind of way, not all that long ago, in my own lifetime, let alone in the lifetime of the people I was writing about, to see that kind of change. And nowadays, you know, we have my colleagues, my friends at MIT in physics, you know, who teach their students this stuff, you know, from day one, that if you're going to learn physics, you're going to learn quantum theory, you have to think about things like Bell's theorem. And that's a pretty quick turnaround.
How interested are your students? And you teach the history of physics, right? What else do you teach?
Well, I teach, but I'm in both the physics department and I teach the history of science as well.
Are your students interested in all, or are they aware about the intention part of it? What you can
it's
do
not
with
clear.
Mind, like the work of Bob John and of Dean Radin and Bill Tiller, do they know about those things?
I don't know. Not that I know of, in fact. I'm not sure. Some of them certainly might. I don't know.
Well, I just think it's probably the single most important thing in the world for them to understand that. Anyway, so how do you view what these people have done, how do you view it contributing to the advancement of science in the world?
Well, you know, I gave the book a very kind of playful title called How the Hippies Saved Physics. And some readers or some reviewers have thought that title was overkill. And I mean, the point was actually to be kind of fun, to be ironic and playful. So I don't think this group saved all of physics. I don't think any group of individuals saved an entire discipline of several hundreds of thousands of people. So, I mean, the title was meant to be taken with a grain of salt. That being said, what I just relished, what I really loved finding as I dug in more in the book, were the number of ways that this group, a very modest platform, very smart and earnest and passionate, but not in central locations in the discipline by any means, but nonetheless, they've left a kind of legacy and a footprint that many of us now in physics, you know, are trafficking in all the time, even if we don't know sort of how we got there. And that includes, for example, rescuing this topic of Bell's theorem from real obscurity, saying this is important, it needs to be tested, doing those tests, and then framing a series of these thought experiments to push on that boundary between quantum theory and Einstein's relativity, to the point where every single demonstration we have now, the way we can teach our students, in fact, that Bell's theorem is compatible with relativity, it does obey the sort of nothing traveling faster than light. If you think about it in very, very careful, sophisticated ways, every way that we know of squaring those two pillars of our science came from members of the group I was writing about, or as direct responses to their very clever, you know, thoughts and ideas and their calculations. So the way we know that the two most important elements of modern physics actually can be compatible is because this kind of ragtag, you know, down-in-the-luck kind of group wouldn't stop and wouldn't say no and kept pressing on that important issue. And then there were more specific results that followed downstream from that, like one that I write about in the book called the no-cloning theorem.
That's my next question. I've got it turned to page 196 right now to ask you that question.
Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to know about it. I'd never heard of it, so I wanted you to explain it more.
The no-cloning theorem. It's not nearly so famous as Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. It's actually fairly similar. The ideas are similar, but it's of much, much more recent origin. It was discovered three different times by physicists in Europe and the United States. They were independent discoveries, but each of them was triggered by the same event, which was trying to figure out the kind of fatal flaw in one of these really quite clever thought experiments by a member of the group I was writing about, in this case by Nick Herbert of the Fundamental Physics Group. Jack Sarfati had similar ideas. The two of them were hashing these out as part of the group discussions. And the idea was, if Bell's theorem really does imply this instantaneous connection between particle A and particle B, could you put that to work? Could you send signals faster than light? Could you violate relativity? And both Jack Sarfati and then Nick Herbert really ran with that. They were doing real calculations, trying to imagine devices that one could build with quantum theory that might really poke a hole in relativity. And the fact that one can't build those machines, at least as far as we know, at least according to our current understanding of quantum theory, we now know such machines won't work as designed because of this very subtle effect now that's now called the no-cloning theorem. And we now know that because of these efforts to basically to find the fatal flaw in Sarfati's and Nick Herbert's design. So that's another kind of legacy from the group that we had otherwise not been really acknowledged. So the no-cloning theorem itself, like the name implies, says that according to the laws of quantum theory, it is impossible to make an exact copy of an unknown quantum state. So if someone hands you some quantum particle, but you don't know what state it's already in, you don't know its spin along the x direction, for example, you can't make copies of that without disturbing the original state itself. And so that becomes something like the uncertainty principle. It's not quite the same thing. But that notion, the so-called no-cloning theorem, is the centerpiece of now a truly multi-billion dollar industry called quantum encryption. That's how people are trying to safeguard, communications, whether they're money wires or any message you want to keep secret. The fact that at the deepest level of nature that we know of, at the heart of quantum theory, one can make signals based out of quantum particles, and anyone who tried to tap into that signal, copy that signal, try to break the code, would destroy the signal itself and would get nothing but random noise. And so the no-cloning theorem and Bell's theorem behind that is the centerpiece of this, you know, really quite exciting, cutting-edge new technology. And we only know that. We only had those ideas to even think of the technology because of this, you know, very playful but otherwise humble group that I was focusing on in the book. And so when I say, you know, what's their legacy, and I say jokingly in the title, they saved physics, they didn't save all of physics, but no one saved all of physics. But look at all they did, right? Look at the amazing things that came forth from their determination and their skill and their playfulness. They really wanted to push with these ideas and play with them. And that was, you know, it was really fun to try to uncover all that.
So if I ask you, how does the no-cloning theory relate to consciousness? Can you tell me that?
Well, I'd be speculating, but I can give you some quick ideas at least. And these are just on the fly, right? But one thing it would seem to suggest would be that it might be impossible to make a perfect copy of someone's consciousness. If we think that consciousness has some basis in, say, the quantum state of all the stuff in one's mind and or brain, And the no cloning theorem comes in and says, well, you can't make an exact copy of that. We can't make a sort of bit for bit copy of that without destroying some of the state it was in, without altering the state. Then it seems to suggest that making a, say, an exact copy of one person's consciousness really might violate the laws of physics, or it might not. That would be a topic then for further study. And I certainly haven't studied it with great care. But it would, that would be the kind of question that this group back in the day was all about. I mean, they would just dig into that. They'd say, what are the implications, and what might it imply? If A leads to B, does B lead to C? And that's what they did with great skill and great tenacity.
So what are, there was one other thing I wanted to ask before we went into this. You talk in your book about some things people are doing now, the Perimeter Institute and the mm-hmm. Foundational Questions Institute. What are those two things, and is that something that's relatively new? Is it something that people are carrying on? What are those things?
Sure, yeah. I did, in the coda, the sort of epilogue to the book, I mentioned... you know, one of the themes of the book in general was that this group that I was mostly focusing on, the fundamental physics group, they really had to blaze their own path, right? This was against a backdrop of, you know, a sudden drop in funding, sudden change in the job market. These folks had to make their own way and be very clever and very entrepreneurial, and they succeeded. They really were. And so that meant finding their own source of funds. That wasn't going to be the standard way of funding physics research in its day. It meant finding their own kind of, home base, their own institutions from which to have their discussions and try to spread the word, their own ways of communicating the results. They had to build up a kind of parallel universe to the regular way of doing physics. And at least for the better part of a decade, they really did. And that's how we have these kind of spin-off effects from the legacy that they've left to this day. And so I was curious in wrapping up the book, you know, people who might be a bit out of the mainstream today, but still have, you know, great skill in physics, great training, have questions they really burning, you know, they want to really pursue, even if those questions might not be the most popular in the mainstream, would those people today have to do like the members did in the 70s and recreate their own, you know, money and institutions and home base and communication outlets? And I think the answer is not really. So that's where places like the Perimeter Institute or the FQXI group that I mentioned, they come in. So these are relatively new. They're both, say, on the order of a decade old. They're not 40 years old. They're not 6 months old. They're a couple years. And they
who
are they
these
set up,
people that are doing this? I mean, is it, and where are those located? I'd love to check into them myself.
Sure. So the Perimeter Institute is in Canada. It's outside Toronto. It's in the city or the town of Waterloo, Ontario. It's right next to the University of Waterloo, and they have close connections there. But it is basically an autonomous, an independent research institute for certain areas of theoretical physics. And it was founded in part to be able to support types of research, topics that really were not getting attention in the sort of leading university departments. And that meant things like the foundations of quantum theory, the kinds of questions about Bell's theorem that the group I was writing about had been pursuing back in the day. It means certain approaches to quantum gravity that were not the most popular ones in the universities, but still might deserve a fighting chance to have people really, you know, sit with them and try to figure them out. Quantum cosmology, can we merge our ideas about quantum theory with our understanding of the universe as a whole? So it was a place to be able to pursue questions that were real physics questions, but that weren't flourishing in the mainstream places. And it was had a very generous funding from a private entrepreneur, as well as eventually some government funding from the Canadian government and provincial governments. So it's a flourishing, it's a very elite place now, in fact, a very exciting place. But and I've sent my students there. I've had students who work with me as undergraduates who've gone there to do masters. It's a wonderful, wonderful, exciting place. I love visiting there. And so that's an example where people who are into questions that might not be at the most popular in some university departments can nonetheless have this very 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 well supported and very exciting place to go and not have to make it up all on their own, make up their own institution. FQXI, the other one that I mentioned, is actually entirely virtual. It's just a website-based, you know, an internet-based group. They have funding from a bunch of private donors. I think they've also gotten funding from the Templeton Foundation as well. But in general, it's a kind of way of dispersing small, modest amounts of funds to physicists or to people who apply, who are also interested in questions that are not otherwise getting the main funding from the usual sources. And so that often means things like the foundations of quantum theory, it could mean quantum cosmology, and that kind of stuff.
So what are any of them doing, Elizabeth and George and Fred, or what are they doing anything now that my listeners might be interested in hearing about? And also, we've got about 15 minutes, so I'd like for you to take time to talk about anything you want to talk about.
Okay.
That we haven't covered, or even if we have, if you'd like to emphasize something.
Sure. So, one of the great pleasures of doing recent history is that all the people I was writing about are still alive, and they were extremely generous with their time. So I got to talk with Elizabeth Rauscher a couple times, with George, in fact, in person many times, which was a great treat, with Fred Allen Wolfe and Jack Sarfati and Nick Herbert, and Fritjof Capra and John Clauser. I mean, each of them were very, very, generous with their time. And many of them, including, John Clauser and Nick Herbert especially, and George Weissman, in fact, and Elizabeth, I guess, and most of them did, were able to send me documents from back in the day. So for an historian, you know, it's really important to sit down with someone and say, what happened to you back then? Can you tell me how you got from A to B? But it's really good to be able to sort of triangulate like a detective with, you know, kind of written documents from that time. And they need to be published. It could be, you know, unpublished letters. It could be notebooks, you know, research notebooks. It could be little, you know, papers that they were doodling on at the time that didn't actually get published. And so I was able to talk with these folks today, or, you know, in recent times. And also they were very kind in going back to their own personal files and sending me stuff that was really just fascinating. That filled out more of the picture, more of the kind of connecting the dots of what I was able to find through other means. So one of the ways I was learning about the group was because they were very avidly corresponding with people whom I mentioned before, like John Wheeler, this very, very eminent physicist. He just passed away a few years ago. He lived well into his 90s, a revered physicist of the modern age. And because John Wheeler became a very prominent, you know, famous physicist when he did pass away, his papers were deposited in a fancy archive so scholars could go and research there. And lo and behold, thousands and thousands of pages in his personal papers were correspondence or notes or preprints from members of this group I was trying to track. So they were being sent to him in the 70s, in the 80s, the papers that date from the times I was writing about. So I could have leads from there. Same thing with Richard Feynman's archives, where they corresponded quite a bit with Feynman, the beloved Nobel laureate and famed physicist, and other folks like that. Wojciech Zurek loaned me his research notebook from the time, so I could see day by day how he was very avidly beating his head against these clever challenges from members of the group. He was one of these people who derived what's now called that no-cloning theorem I mentioned before. And so Zurek loaned me his notebook. So there's a way to kind of, you know, pinpoint how their ideas were beginning to percolate, were spreading out outside of their own little discussion group and having a kind of impact, sometimes a surprising impact, on some of their peers. And so because of that, I was able to sit down and talk with George Weissman and talk on the phone with Elizabeth and so on. So I do know, for example, George, I believe, is still working on a book on his ideas about the quantum theory and consciousness, and so that's still a great interest of his. I believe Elizabeth is also still, you know, avidly doing work in this area. I'm not familiar with the most recent work of theirs, other than that I know they're still active and still very passionate about it.
Yeah, I think George is writing his, that's what he plans to do now. I told you he was out of town now. That's one of the things he's going to be doing and try to have a draft within the next 6 months to mm-hmm. take a look at. So hopefully that'll be forthcoming. And Elizabeth, too, I think hers will be ready in the next couple of months to take a look mm-hmm. at if all goes
yeah.
well. So are you there?
I am, yeah.
Okay. We have. Are you near your base?
Yes.
Okay.
Can you hear me okay?
It goes in and out. Anyway, is there anything that you had particular fun with or of particular interest that came up when you were doing this that we haven't already talked about that you'd like my listeners to know?
Well, I guess I enjoyed every day that I got to work on the book, and that's not always the case. This really was such a pleasure, partly because the people, as I say, were sort of fascinating and very smart and very passionate and very generous in sharing their materials with me. And partly because, you know, these are some of the most sort of deep questions or topics in modern physics. So anyone who's interested in physics, you know, I think would enjoy thinking about these ideas. And then to see them, you know, play out against this very colorful period in American cultural history and political history, you know, the waning of the Vietnam War and the kind of 70s counterculture was, you know, just a fascinating time in its own right. That became, Berkeley became a character in the story as much as any of the other people. And so, you know, the whole combination really just grabbed me. It was an absolute pleasure to be able to work on.
And most of these people have such great humility, too, I think. That's what I found about them anyway.
I think so. And also, I must say, a good sense of humor, which I guess they had to have, right? And they really were facing, at times at least, quite serious, you know, professional adversity. And yet they, you know, they sort of didn't take themselves too seriously. They gave themselves their very playful name for their group. And yet they stuck to it, you know, even when other people dismissed them or wouldn't even pay attention. And so I think, you know, that is fun. I mean, certainly, look, Fred Allen Wolf, you know, he's a very funny guy. Most of they all are. But at one point in the early 80s, as you may know, I mentioned it briefly in the book, Fred was actually the opening act for Timothy Leary in Los Angeles. And he was basically, at that point, he'd become a kind of quantum physics stand-up comedian, popular author, you know, entertainer. Of course the guy's funny. He's terrific, right? And so they're the way in which they are, you know, they're just, like I say, they're clever and smart and passionate about their ideas, and that's a fun thing to be able to work on.
You know, one thing that I thought was interesting in this book, and this is a little bit off the topic of consciousness, I just wanted to share it with you. You know, when you talked in there about that experience that Uri Geller had with that computer calling him up?
Yes.
Who told you about that? I'm just curious. How'd you find out about that?
Well, right. So I do write about it a bit in the book. So back in the day, that was being written about by some of the people who were close to Geller. I can't remember now if Geller himself had written about it as well, but certainly Andreja Puharich featured those episodes in one of his books about Uri Geller. And I actually learned about it before I knew to look in Puharich's books from Jack Sarfati's kind of memoirs or reminiscences. Jack recalls a very similar experience, and Jack had written about that, and by that point I was on to the whole fundamental physics group, and I knew Jack Sarfati was a main member, so I was reading Jack's sort of recollections, and he pointed me, his footnotes pointed me toward the Geller thing as well, which I had not known about before. So it's one of those, you know, and it's still an episode that Jack, you know, still recalls, and he still emails about to other colleagues, so it's certainly something that made an impact on his life.
Well, the reason I ask is because something kind of like that happened to me, and I'm such a skeptic, even though I have a show like this. I'm really such a skeptic, and
uh-huh.
Even though I'm a medical intuitive and I do this stuff, I'm really a big skeptic. One night, about 11 o'clock, I have a teenage daughter, and we live up in the middle of the woods in the Appalachian Mountains, and we don't even have a TV, okay, or a radio. I just have my computer, which is in a separate room. And we were standing in the kitchen, and I said, I think I'm going to bed. And she went, well, I'm going to get something to eat. And I went, okay, I'll have a cup of coffee then. So we both walked into this little tiny pantry that's maybe 4 foot by 5 foot, and we were stumbling over each other. I was reaching over her head, and she was reaching for whatever she was getting. And we started laughing, so we were literally guffawing. And I'm into sustainability, so I have lots of lint, you know, 50-pound bags of lentils or pinto beans or black beans or brown rice all stored in this little thing. And out of nowhere, amidst our guffawing, this woman's, and I know this sounds crazy, but I swear it happened, this female computerized voice started talking from this 50-pound bag of lentils. And both of us stopped dead in our tracks. Obviously, we stopped laughing, looked at each other, and she said to me, did you hear that? And I said, yes, I did. And so I picked up the phone, and I went out on the porch because it kind of freaked me out, and I called this friend of mine, Stanislavo Jack, who does some work with Bill Tiller. I don't know if you know him. But
I don't.
And said, you're not going to believe this, but I just got this book in the mail today from Stan Gregero or something like that. And Stanislav Ojak has a PhD in architecture and a PhD in psychology. And this other man writes about aliens or UFO or something. I don't know. I'm not really into that. But he had hired my friend Stanislavo Jack to do a psychological evaluation on him because he had a new book coming out. And he said, I'm on page 49 right now of this book reviewing it, and I'm reading a paragraph where that exact same thing happened to this man. Now, where the heck does a voice like that come from, I guess is what I want to know. Where does it come from? Mm-hmm. How did a voice like that come out of my bag of lentils?
I do not know.
I have no radio, no television, nothing. Where did it come
right,
from?
Right, right, right. I don't know. But, you know, so I know that other members of the group that I was writing about, you know, have similar stories. I mentioned Jack. I think George Weissman has. I don't think it was that episode, but he certainly has spoken of similar kinds of things. And so, you know, that was part of what was in the mix for them, that this is, you know, something that they took very seriously and they wanted to you know, to think hard about.
Yeah. It just, it kind of just blew me away to hear a voice come out of nowhere, a female digital voice. Anyway, so why don't you tell us again where we can find you? I didn't mean to get off topic, so please forgive me, but it just caught my attention that someone else has had that experience.
Right.
Why don't you tell us where we can buy this book and where we can find you if people want to read about you?
Sure, and, sure. Well, I'd be delighted. So the book, it's called How the Hippies Saved Physics. The subtitle is Science, Counterculture, and the Quantum Revival. It's out in bookstores now. In fact, the paperback is just being released as we speak. In fact, it's good timing. So it's in hardcover, it's in paperback, it's in, you know, e-books if anyone is interested. And it should be hopefully available wherever people are doing their book shopping. And I teach at MIT, and I'm in the program in Science, Technology, and Society, and also the Department of Physics.
It's a wonderful book. I thank you. Another thing, what did your peers, now you're in history, so I can imagine it probably wasn't so bad, but what did your peers think when you read this book?
Well, you know, it's gotten some interesting reactions. And from my younger physics colleagues, the ones who are working in areas like quantum information science today, there's been a great enthusiasm, great support, even from many of my older colleagues in physics, many of them who also remember the very, very hard times for physicists in the 70s, what it was like when funding was cut and jobs were cut. And then for many of my historian colleagues, you know, they've been very excited to see, you know, a fairly recent historical topic being treated the way we might treat, you know, that we're using a kind of historical tools we might use to talk about, you know, Darwin or Newton or Einstein, much older, longer ago topics, that we can start doing history of fairly recent times and do, you know, archive research and get documents from the period and cross-check all our information. And so a number of my historian colleagues have commented on that they liked that there's a way of doing history of the recent past that can still be using the tools that we like to use for understanding the longer ago times. And so
plan on, or have you even talked about putting together any kind of document about the recent history of human intention and things like the Global Consciousness Project that Roger Nelson's working on of Princeton, and Bill Tiller's work with intention devices. Does anybody plan on looking at all of that and putting it all in one place? Because people don't know that this is going on. I mean, I talked to Henry Stepp one day, Bill, I don't know if you know Bill Tiller. Are you familiar with him?
I'm not, no.
He was the chairman of the physics department at Stanford, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, Henry Stepp didn't know about his work. And there's all this work going on in quantum mechanics, and the people don't even know what their peer is doing. And it seems like if everything was put in one place so that they all knew that it was going on, that we could have a quantum leap and understanding and make more things happen. Does anybody even know or plan on doing anything like that?
Well, if they do, I don't know about it. That's maybe for the reason you just said, maybe because we haven't made those connections yet. But there could well be. I don't know.
Okay. I was just curious. Well, Thank you so much for coming on my show. I think your book is fabulous. It was very informative, and not only that, but it was entertaining to get to read about all these people that we're reading their individual books on, how they started. It was great. Thank you.
Well, I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for your interest in the book. I'm so glad to be on the show.
It was great. Thank you. Good night.
Okay, good night.